people do amazing things every day, and yet most of us feel like we can't do our taxes ourselves. That doesn't make any sense. TurboTax believes that with the right tools and encouragement, people can do anything. Yes, even taxes. And with TurboTax Live, you have access to CPAs on demand who are available even on nights and weekends to answer your questions or give you advice to help make sure you do your taxes right and get your best possible refund. TurboTax. All people are tax people.
Welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Mason Avenue's Modern League podcast. I'm Steve Seipa, and I'm joined by Lucas, Ken, and Thomas. How are you guys doing this week?
All right.
Doing well. How are you?
Yeah, doing pretty well.
All right, that's good. So let's jump into it right here with promote, extend, trade. And on this date in 1886, John Pemberton had to change the formula of his patented product, Pemberton's French Wine Coca, because there were some temperance legislations enacted in his native Atlanta. So he removed the wine from the product, and he replaced it with carbonated water, and Coca-Cola was born. So promote, extend, trade all the different versions of Coca-Cola that's out there. Past and present. And Ken, I just realized probably you're going to want to trade all of them, huh?
Yeah, so I don't drink soda anymore, but I do have very strong Coke opinions, so.
Okay, well, that's good then. So you'll have an opinion then, that's good. All right, so first we'll go with what are we all going to promote?
Can I, like, get rid of, I would trade all of them because I just don't like Coke in general.
Okay.
I'm the person without the opinion. You thought wrong.
Is it just limited to Coke? Are you one of those people that like hates Coke but loves Pepsi?
I don't. So I used to drink Coke growing up, but then I kind of A, grew out of liking the taste, and B, the caffeine just gave me miserable headaches. So throw all the Coke right in the trash. Pepsi just tastes terrible. Also throw it in the trash. Look up with, like, Sprite, cream soda, you know?
Sprite. All right, well.
Is soda.
Well, Lucas is the trade everything guy. All right, yeah. Well then, everyone except for him.
Go ahead, Thomas.
I'm trying to think of the last time I had Coke. I usually just have, like, standard Coke, like, just the normal kind. I did have Coke Zero at a movie theater once, and I liked it, but I don't know if that was just – it was midnight, and I was at a movie theater, and I was like, oh, this is pretty good, or, like, I actually like it. So I think I'm going to promote the original normal Coke.
I'm going to have to agree.
Yeah, I promoted regular Coke, too. I was thinking about the Coke with lemon, which they used to have, which I know I liked, but I was, like, in high school back then, or maybe even junior high school. So I feel like I would need to taste it again to think, you know, to verify whether or not it was just, like, kid taste buds that was just...
Yeah, I get you.
Filtering out all the chemicals and too much sweetness, whatever. But I just went with regular Coke. And what are we extending? What is our absolute favorite Coke variation here?
I'm going to go vanilla Coke.
Yeah, vanilla's good.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty great up until I think they stopped making it or something.
Didn't they make like an orange vanilla version and they kept having those ads where those trucks crashed into each other?
Probably. They've made orange. A lot of sodas.
That's the one that I extended cherry vanilla Coke, which is a flavor.
It was a cherry vanilla maybe that had
that. Yeah. Control? Because cherry Coke is my favorite, and vanilla Coke is my favorite, and it would have been like Sophie's choice having to choose them, but luckily they sell them together, so I'm good. And then what are you guys trading?
Just everything else.
There is an orange vanilla, by the way.
I'm a big fan of that flavor. I should also clarify that I grew up drinking Diet Coke, and I actually don't like plain Coke.
Interesting.
Because I'm a fucking psychopath, apparently.
Clearly.
Well, Lucas, do you like sweet things in general?
Oh, absolutely. I have a horrifically bad sweet tooth. It's a real problem. But I grew out of the Diet Coke thing, too.
Well, I'm trading Diet Coke because I just hate the fake sugar aftertaste.
Uh-huh. It's weird because all the other diet sodas taste terrible to me, too. Like, I don't drink Diet Sprite. Where the hell is that?
Ooh.
Yeah, exactly.
I think they all are pretty bad, though. Mm. Like, most diet drinks, I don't know.
I'll get a large cheeseburger and a large fry and then make it a Diet Coke, you know? Gotta watch my waistline.
It's the American way.
I'm on Coke's website right now, and there's something called Coca-Cola Life.
Is that the thing that there's an ad with Jonah Hill and Martin Scorsese's? It's got like extra caffeine or something like that.
It has a plant based sweetener in it.
Oh, okay, like agave sugar stuff.
But I do know that there might be Coke Energy, Lucas.
Yeah, that's it. I think
it's the Jonah Hill commercial because I've seen that commercial quite a bit. Yep, I clicked on the Coke Energy part of Coca-Cola's website and the Martin Scorsese commercial came up. So
there it goes.
Also, if you want to shop Coke on their website, it brings you to Amazon.
Of course it does. It's not of course it does. You know.
So I mean, I have Amazon Pantry open now with all the different types of Coke.
There's a lot.
Yeah. There's more than I realized.
Yeah, it's like Kit Kats, like in Japan, how they have all the crazy Kit Kat flavors, but we really don't have any of that here. Same thing with Coke. Some of the stuff that they make in other countries, I don't know if it will be good or bad. You know, I don't know if, like, kiwi strawberry Coke is good or not, but it just sounds very interesting. All right. So with the current lack of baseball to look forward to and everything, I think that our best bet is to look back. And one of the things that we're going to be rolling out soon is a kind of updated feature that Jeffrey Paternoster started a couple of years ago, the Prospect Graveyard. You know, the Mets aren't alone in having draft picks and prospects not work out. But maybe it's just confirmation bias or whatever. But it seems like the Mets have had a lot of these failures kind of turn into stories that really color how we remember the era. For example, Generation K. You know, it's just supposed to be three pretty good pitching prospects. And they were the guys that were supposed to turn the early 90s team, the quote-unquote worst team money could buy, into a contender. But they fizzled out, and they prolonged, you know, that period of poor play and everything. And now we remember, you know, that mid-90s Generation K. And it's, you know, an unfortunate thing in Mets history.
I think a lot of people don't realize how well our current pool of starting pitching prospects actually worked out. Like,
yeah, I mean, it really is incredible that nobody really – I mean, who is the worst one you could really think of? Rafael Montero, I guess.
Sure.
And he kind of had a little bit of a career resuscitation, I think, in Texas last year.
Yeah,
so,
he was on the Rangers last year.
Yeah, so, I mean, if he is the worst failure of this kind of 2000 pitching
– Chris Flexen, maybe?
Yeah, that's true. Chris Flexen, okay.
I mean, Harvey's kind of a special case, but...
Harvey had the actual, like, major league success, though, like...
Right. That one. And then he had the worst injury.
Yeah.
I mean, you could argue that Matt's never quite made good on some of the hype.
Baseball's weird that way, to me, because, like, Matz is clearly a major league caliber pitcher, and it's also kind of disappointing. Like,
yep.
It's so weird that, like, a dude could be a third, fourth starter and be like, eh.
Yeah.
That's sad, because it should be more. I mean, even Syndergaard sometimes, like, makes me mad the way he pitches and the way he's performed with the stuff that he's had. And I don't want to call him a failure, because I don't think that's true, but.
No, I know what you mean, though. When you think of Noah Syndergaard, you think of all the insinuations that this is going to be like a Cy Young caliber pitcher. And
yeah, like from a raw stuff standpoint, he should be like a top five pitcher in the game, and instead he's a top 20 pitcher in the game, and it feels disappointing.
Yeah, exactly.
Good disappointment, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's not logical fallacy, that's not the word I'm looking for. It's just like a perception thing, right? Like you set certain expectations and then can't recalibrate.
It's very true. You know, so we're all prospect guys. It's definitely fun, but one of the sad parts, I guess, if you want to call it sad, is that, you know, we follow a guy, we start buying into them, whatever, and then things go wrong. Maybe it's an injury, not enough talent, whatever, but, you know, the majority of these players don't really make it. And a lot of times, most of the time, they're guys that, you know, you don't have a connection with, but sometimes, though, it is. So going as far back as you guys have really followed the Mets, followed the minors closely, whatever, what is one of, like, your guys, quote-unquote, that, you know, just didn't make it? Does anyone want to go first, or should I, or?
You should go first.
All right. So one guy that I liked, thought was exciting back in the day, I still kind of joke about now occasionally, is Juan Urbina. Mets signed him around the time that I first kind of really, like, obsessively started following the Mets. And him and Henry Mejia were like these two young phenoms all the way at the bottom of the system. Urbina was a left-hander, and obviously his father, Ugith Urbina, was an all-star, so that kind of made, to me anyway, Urbina more exciting than Mejia, although obviously Mejia was, and still is, a much better pitcher. And I guess in retrospect, being more familiar with player evaluation and everything in the years since, and then the whole process being more, like, democratic, I don't know, like, online, like, I can't think of the word, but we have all this information on the internet and whatever, so, you know, that kind of information wasn't really available 10 years ago. I don't think I would have been as hyped on Urbina as I was. You know, the stuff was okay, nothing amazing or anything, though. It was mid to high 80s fastball with, like, an above-average changeup and an average curve, which is solid for a 16, 17-year-old kid. But, you know, nothing to put him on the same level as a guy like Mejia. A guy, I guess, in the system right now with similar stuff at a similar age is David Marcano. And he's not getting anybody particularly excited about him. Urbina, you know, maybe the Mets gave up on him a little too early. He was 19 in Brooklyn and Kingsport when they put him in the bullpen and just kind of forgot about him, I guess. But obviously they had more information than me. And obviously it's not like he proved them wrong or anything, because he just kind of kicked around for a few more years in Brooklyn. And then he got released in 2014 when he was 21. And he hasn't been in baseball since. So I guess it's just like a cautionary tale, I guess, that guys don't always develop to the most optimistic projections. You know, optimistically, he would have been a guy to put on more weight, get his fastball to regularly sit in the low 90s, and that would complement his secondary stuff better. But in reality, he just never improved. The fastball just kind of stuck in the mid to high 80s, and, you know, you're not really challenging anybody with a mid to high 80s fastball. And that's Juan Urbina.
No, it's his dad. His dad's the criminal, right?
Yes, he was put in prison in prison in Venezuela for quite a few years for attempted murder of.
That's gotta be one of the craziest baseball stories out there.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I think it was like three guys that worked on his farm that he doused in gasoline, threatened with a machete, and threatened to light on fire for doing
Jesus
something.
Christ. Oh boy.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that was his son.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that he's out of prison now.
Not a lot of room for interpretation there with that list of accusations, you know?
Clearly, you don't want to get on his bad side.
You won't like me when I'm angry. I think I actually saw him on one of the top prospect lists I was coming to when I was looking. Yep, he's one spot above my guy on the Fangraphs 2010 list.
Yeah, he was on, I think he was like our 11th top prospect in 2010.
Uh-huh.
And Rob Castellano was still running things. And then like 30th or something like that in 2011.
Mm.
And if, you know, same thing, like I was kind of saying, if we had more information about all these players back then, like we do now, then it's doubtful that he would have maybe been as high as he was, even though the Mets system was really not that great at the time, at the turn of like the 2010s. But I mean, like I said, a guy like David Marcano, who was signed, I think, not last August, but the year before, and is in the GCL now, the Dominican, similar kind of very young right-hander, very raw, but, you know, a lot of projection. He was on no consideration for any top prospects lists, whereas Urbina was because of just the name and the hype.
I wonder how much the name actually helps, like, subconsciously.
Because, probably a lot.
Yeah, because you just look, you're like, oh, son of a former all-star, like, that kind of, I wonder how much it colors your thoughts without you even knowing it.
And then you just have the literal connection, you know, from the actual, you know, tangible benefits of it, too.
Exactly.
All right, who is who's the dude that you guys liked?
I'll go next, since, like I said, he's on the same prospect list. So I really got into baseball in 2006, really, which lined up perfectly with when the Mets brought Fernando Martinez into the system, a.k.a. F-Mart. So he was a Dominican signing in 2005. And then the hype machine got rolling. And similar to Steve, I think if we had the information we had today, young Lucas would have known not to get hype about newly signed 16-year-olds from the Dominican. But you live and learn, right? So F-Mart was highly regarded on his way up, like between the late 2000s, in the late aughts, I guess you'd call that. Just hit well and hit okay at most levels, but the scouting reports were all exemplary. He was on a top 50 prospect list at BP and Fangraphs. And there was some fatigue during the end there. Like, he came up at the end of the 2009 season and was pretty awful. 38 weighted runs created, which, that's not great. Similar story in 2010 when he got another cup of coffee with the Mets. And what really happened is the injuries got to him. So his knees just were totally shot, sapped a lot of his athleticism, a lot of his speed, his ability to play defense at a reasonable level, and ultimately his baseball ability as a whole. So he kicked around with the Mets for a couple years. He never really got an extended chance, but also wasn't doing a whole lot in AAA. Then he went to the Astros, where he had one season where he got 130 plate appearances and was very slightly above average. But they didn't hold on to him after that. He went to the Yankees, and then got suspended for the whole Biogenesis thing, which, if you remember, is the steroid scandal that caught A-Rod and a couple other guys up in that.
I think presidential advisor A-Rod.
Right. President. Hey, A-Rod, how do I deal with this pandemic? You know, because you definitely understand. So after that suspension, I don't know that he ever appeared in affiliated ball again. I know he went down to the Mexican League for a little bit in 2015, but that was only for 7 games, and he hasn't played since. So just another prospect who was really ravaged by injuries. And I mean, I hope his knees aren't too bad now, because that's not something that gets better as you age.
No, definitely not.
At the time, he was like – it was like a big deal. Like, F. Mart was supposed to be a big deal. And he kind of, if you were a new fan who got caught up in that 2006 run, and then you are like, well, okay, now I'm into the team. What else do I get excited about? Like, oh, well, here's this new prospect that you can just dream on for the next 5 years. And didn't work out so great, unfortunately. I'm actually looking at the BP 101 from 2009, where F. Mart was 44th. It's a trip. There are a lot of names on this that don't make a lot of sense in retrospect.
Such as?
Well, Wieters first, fine. Price, Bumgarner, then Pedro Alvarez third, Travis Snyder fifth.
Oh yeah, Alvarez was a big deal.
Oh, he was.
Yeah, I remember him.
In prospect circles.
Yeah.
I remember him being a big prospect.
Colby Rasmus at 8. I remember being so certain that Colby Rasmus was going to be a monster and just never worked out. Cameron Maben at 11th.
I thought he was going to be good.
And he's
had a solid career, but.
Yeah, he's sort of kicked around for a while. The biggest bust here is probably Lars Anderson at 17. That didn't work out so well. Or at all.
Jeez.
Craig Hallman at 42. I've never even heard that name before.
Well, it says it all, I guess.
Yeah. Ben Revere was a top 40 prospect? What?
Lars Anderson was the Red Sox prospect, right? I'm back a little.
Lars Anderson, yeah, he's the first base prospect for the Red Sox and just never hit, really.
Yeah, I remember him.
The three guys in front of, or the four, F. Mart was 44. Ahead of him is, just ahead of him, J.P. Arencibia, Greg Hallman, Carlos Carrasco, and just behind him, Willen Rosario, Austin Jackson. And then Angel Villalona. No idea who that is.
Nope.
Who are these people? So.
Yeah, that was, I mean, F. Mart was supposed to be the next, you know, him and Lastings Millage were supposed to be like these two star outfielders. Yeah. That...
Millage was who I almost picked. I was close to picking Millage because I remember being a kid and being like, oh, yes. Like, I was like 12 in 2006, so I was like, hell yeah, this is the future, without really knowing anything, because why would I? Just like hearing their names and stuff.
You know, Lucas, you mentioned not getting burned by all these young Dominicans, mm-hmm. but yet I am going to mention that you are the one that ranked Adrian Hernandez and Stanley Consuegra, two young hitting outfielder Dominicans.
Steve, are you implying that I should have learned from my mistakes?
I'm just saying.
I'm pretty sure that's not allowed here.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
Well, yeah, imagine what a good F. Mart, what a difference he could have made in, you know.
And he's not even one of those ones where it's a scouting failure. It's like very clearly an injury thing. Now, it could have also been a scouting failure, but we'll never know. Also, if any of us learned from our mistakes, we would no longer be Met fans. So it's like paradoxical that we would learn from our mistakes.
That is a very, very, very good point.
I'm trying to remember, but didn't the Twins want F. Mart in the Johan deal?
Yes, I'm pretty sure that we were able to switch out Carlos Gomez instead.
Yeah, and it was like a big like win for the Mets at the time because it was like you Oops. Got Johan and you didn't really and you kept F Mart and it's like well.
What was that full package? It was Gomez, Humber, Diales Guerra, and
Kevin Mulvey.
Right, right. That's it. That's it.
Which is like a whole bunch of yikes, really.
Hey, Philip Humber threw a no hitter. Did he throw a perfect game?
Oh, I don't remember. I'll look it up right now.
Anyway.
But yeah, I guess all of them are cautionary tales that prospects don't always pan out. So when
it was
you have
a perfect
the,
game.
Oh, when you have the ability to trade a bunch of kind of okay prospects for a Cy Young caliber pitcher, do it.
Yeah. I will say we are our prospect information is definitely much better now.
Yes.
I think that's also something that gets ignored a lot of the times when people are arguing about trading top prospects. Like, well, in 2008, we traded 5 top 10 guys. It's like, well, in 2008, the top 10 list was garbage. It meant literally nothing.
But also, like, sometimes they just won't work out anyway.
Yeah.
Like, you really never know.
Yeah.
It sounds like such a cop-out to say, well, you're not going to know how these players pan out, but you really won't. Like, it's entirely possible you look stupid, and it's entirely possible you look like you made the deal of the century.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's there is no rhyme or reason. All right, who is up next?
I could go, because mine is a recent player, Colby Woodmansey, or Woodmansey. Which way is it pronounced? Anyway,
Woodmansey, I believe.
It's Woodmansey. That's what I always like thought because it made more sense to me that way. But the Mets drafted him in the 5th round in 2016, so this is very recent, and he is already out of the organization. So that's all you pretty much need to know about how his career went. But I remember liking him because he hit in college. Like I think he was Arizona State's best player, pretty much, like their best hitter. And it's just one of those things to me, it's very cut and dry. Like, he hit pretty well in college, and then in the minors, he has a career slash line of 213, 268, 276. Or, yeah, 213, 268, 276. So It just doesn't always carry over from a metal bat league with worse players to a professional league with better players. Like, it sounds very obvious, but it's one of those things where I think he's the type of person that makes you take a step back when you're looking at college kids hitting like 300. And it's like, well, that doesn't mean that they're good at the major league, at the minor league level. It just means that they could hit at the college level. So it's one of those things where he had definite like question marks with like how much he pulled the ball, I think it was, and like how like he wasn't really like a super good athlete, but like he hit at the level that he was at. So the Mets took a swing on him and it failed miserably. So it's just one of those things that I think is a cautionary tale that's good to remember when you're talking about the draft, which is still happening in a shortened version. But yeah.
And talking about learning from our mistakes, the Mets clearly did not.
No, they draft this guy all the time. this is the type of dude that they keep going back to the well for, and it's like the opposite of what you should be going back to the well for.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of not having played baseball in any kind of real competitive way, I think that a lot of people don't really realize how different college baseball with a metal bat is as compared to then professional baseball with a wood bat.
Yeah.
It really makes such a difference in the power department.
You can hit balls for miles by accident with a metal bat. Like, if you just get good bat speed on it, it'll go.
I remember watching Woodmansey because he played in the same league as Cal when I was there. The dude just like didn't use his lower half at all.
No,
and would hit bombs
because he was strong upper half and a metal bat, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, no, that's not good. So I liked him too. I thought, hey, well, maybe they can just make him use his lower half. That shouldn't be that hard. No.
Yeah. His best season was in Brooklyn, and he hit 257. Like,
not great.
It just didn't work out.
I wonder though if there was something else behind the scenes that we don't know about, because I mean, he was drafted in 2016 and he was already out of the organization in 2018.
Yeah.
And no, he wasn't particularly good.
DFA a dude.
Yeah, so quickly.
I think he works for like TrackMan now or something.
I remember there was a guy, I guess it is him, yeah, that did go work for an analytic place that recently retired. So, yeah, I guess it is him.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's a good way to turn it around and still get a way of life out of baseball.
Mm-hmm. All right, and Ken, who is who is your disappointment?
My disappointment is another – you know, medical case. Cameron Plank, whom the Mets drafted with their 12th selection in the 2016 draft. And he was famously the pitcher that they gave $1 million to after Anthony Kay. You know, it was revealed that Anthony Kay needed to have Tommy John. So I think Kay took about like a $900,000 bonus cut, and it was just all given to Plank at the last minute to get him to sign and forego his commitment to Louisville. Yeah, I remember thinking, well, cool, they nabbed another one of these guys. A certain amount of them are going to pan out. You know, this unfortunately did not end up being one of them. Mm. I'm pretty sure before he threw, like off of like a professional mound, he tore something in his shoulder and had to miss an entire season plus rehabbing, and then came back and threw like an inning and then got hurt again before finally retiring this year after trying to ramp up again. It just not working, so... I guess the more of these guys you draft, eventually one will work out. But prep pitchers are risky for a reason. So,
did any of the prep pitchers the Mets drafted in that range? Because they did it every year for a couple years, and I don't think any of them worked out.
I mean, they had a little bit of luck up front with like Gizelman.
Yeah.
Define success.
Yeah.
Flexen was one of these guys.
Since I started doing, I want to say in 2016, they drafted from high school pitching Matt Cleveland in the 10th round, Cameron Plank in the 11th round, Garrison Bryant in like the 18th round, and Trent Johnson in like the 30th round or something like that. And of those guys, Trent is gone. Where's Trent? Cleveland is not particularly great. You know, he was like okay in Brooklyn this year. Plank has retired, and Bryant was pretty solid in Brooklyn, but his stuff is kind of it's more of like a Brooklyn mirage, really, I think, than great stuff. So not a great year for prep pitching that the Mets picked.
Yeah, it's always so risky. I feel like there's like 100 failed cases before you hear like the one really good prep pitcher that you end up getting. But
yeah,
still,
I mean,
like, take those swings.
And Plank, I liked Plank the best out of all of them. He had a pretty solid, like, you know, low to mid 90s fastball. I think
he's
very
like wispy.
Yeah.
Like wiry, you know?
He had a kind of funky delivery. Definitely a lot to like.
I really wanted him to work out so I could make physics jokes in the minor league recaps and then the major league ones.
Of course.
Because no, everyone would have been looking at me like I'm speaking fucking Greek, which, you know, possibly.
Oh, if someone doesn't know who Max Planck is and doesn't know basic physics, then that's probably not good.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I guess there are probably more people out there that don't than do.
Mm.
Which, again, is not good.
It might explain some of our current predicaments when you think about it, but that's another podcast.
I'll call A-Rod, he knows.
Ah, yeah, that's it.
Country Crock is now making a dairy-free, plant-based butter that actually tastes like dairy butter. These new plant butter sticks cook and bake just like dairy butter, too. Like, you can definitely use it for all your stress baking needs. Plus, the production of Country Crock plant butter results in less than half the carbon footprint of dairy butter production. Treat your body and the planet a little better and try Country Crock plant butter. It's so good, even butter lovers love it. Find a store near you at countrycrock.com/plant-butter and see what all the plant-based hype is about.
All right. So these are just kind of guys, this variation on the amount of talent that they had, but I don't think that any of them would have ever been considered by anybody to be like the next big thing, you know. In their history, though, the Mets do have a sad story of the next big thing not making it. And for the people who are regular listeners, you might remember that Ken spoke about him at length a few months ago in Oh Yeah, That Guy. And because the anniversary of his death is actually this week on March 31st, I thought it would be a kind of fitting tribute to celebrate the 19th anniversary of his death by talking about him a bit more. And by him, I mean Mets prospect Brian Cole. So back in the late 90s, everything, you know, seemed like it was finally going the Mets' way. They didn't win any World Series, obviously, but they had some pretty good teams in 97 and 98. And then they made the playoffs in 99 and 2000. So things were going good at the MLB level. And then in the minors, things were going pretty well, too, because even though they were winning, the Mets also were drafting and developing a bunch of top prospects in baseball over that couple-year span. A lot of them didn't work out, like we were just discussing, but from like 97 to 2000 or so, in the baseball's top prospect list, you had guys like Alex Escobar, Jay Payton, Octavio Dotel, Grant Roberts, Pat Strange, and then, of course, and probably better than all of them, was Brian Cole. And he was born in Meridian, Mississippi, which randomly I've actually been to in passing. And he was from a family of athletes. His dad was a semi-professional baseball player. One of his brothers played in college. And one of his other brothers played in college. And then he played in the Braves minor league system in the late 80s and early 2000s. And Brian probably looked the least like a baseball player as compared to them. Brian was only 5'9 and weighed 170 pounds, which is obviously very atypical for baseball. But, you know, athletically and talent-wise and everything, he was the best out of all of them. He played football and baseball in high school, and he set records that still stand today, you know, some 20 years later. And he got football scholarships, but he really wanted to play baseball, so he turned them down. And in 1997, the Tigers drafted him. He was selected in the 36th round, but they lowballed him. They offered him just $5,000, so he turned them down. And he went to Navarro College, which is a JUCO in Texas. And he had an insane season. In 60 games, he hit .524 with 27 home runs and 49 stolen bases.
Oh, is that so, all?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it's like a home run every other game, basically. Understandably, Baseball America named him the Junior College Player of the Year. And then in 1998, when the Mets were drafting, they made an agreement with him, and they selected him in the 18th round. And they signed him for $100,000, which, you know, money is different in everything between now and then, but probably still kind of a lowball amount there for what they got, especially. His first year was in 1998, and he played in Kingsport. And he hit 300, 317, 491 in 56 games with 5 homers and 15 stolen bases. Just for a little bit of comparison, Brett Beatty was also a 19-year-old in Kingsport last year, but he was fresh out of high school as opposed to Cole, who was spent a year at JUCO. But Beatty hit 222, 339, 437 in 42 games with 6 homers and no stolen bases. So very similar stats. And, you know, Beatty is in the top 10 on pretty much every single Mets top prospect list. So Cole, you know, was that caliber of a prospect, a top guy in the system. He started the 1999 season with the Capital City Bombers, which was the Mets' Sally affiliate at the time. And in 125 games, he hit 316, 362, 522 with 18 homers and 50 stolen bases. Pretty good.
Jeez.
And then he was promoted to St. Lucie in 2000, and he put up basically the same numbers in a tougher environment. He hit 312, 356, 528 in 91 games with 15 homers and 54 stolen bases. He got promoted to Binghamton near the end of the year. He wasn't really able to keep up that kind of crazy pace, but the numbers were still encouraging. In 46 games in Binghamton, he hit 278, 326, 420 with 4 homers and 15 stolen bases. I kind of was quickly looking for a guy in recent memory that had similar numbers in Binghamton to compare him, like I did with Beatty, but I couldn't find anybody off the top of my head. But suffice to say that, you know, if a player in Binghamton had those kind of numbers, we would be considering them again a top prospect in this system now.
He flew up the system too.
Yeah. But he was talented. He had that kind of, you know, he had the numbers and the stuff to back it up.
No, yeah, of course. I'm not saying he shouldn't have.
Oh yeah.
It's just it's wild how fast he moves.
Mm-hmm. He was the minor league player of the year in 2000 because of that crazy production in St. Lucie, and then kind of continued in Binghamton. And he had, he was the minor league player of the year. He got honored at Chase Stadium, all that good stuff. And it was only really going to be a matter of when he was going to become a regular at Chase. And he hit well in spring training in 2001, but he was assigned back to Binghamton. Presumably he would have spent, you know, maybe the beginning of 2001 season in Binghamton, and then he probably would have been sent to the Norfolk Tides in like May or June, kind of how Pete Alonso and Jeff McNeil were last year. I don't really think that he would have made the major leagues, at least not in any kind of non-cup of coffee capacity, because in 2001, the Mets outfield wasn't the best. But, you know, Benny Agbayani, Jay Payton, Timo Perez, they were all still kind of young, so you needed to see what they still had and let them play. So I don't think that Cole would have made the jump to the majors that year. But after he left spring training, he was driving back to his hometown, Meridian, and somebody basically almost sideswiped him while he was driving. So he kind of swerved to avoid getting hit by that car, and he was driving on the grassy median in between the road, and he was driving a Ford Explorer, and it flipped and it rolled, and unfortunately he wasn't wearing a seatbelt and he was ejected from the car. And he didn't die right there, but he did die a few hours later. And, you know, it wasn't his fault that, you know, the other driver entered his lane, and it wasn't his fault that SUVs, certain models are prone to rolling over, but he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and you got to wear your seatbelt. I think that the government and, you know, just people in charge have done a pretty good job of instilling in everyone that you should always wear your seatbelt. Because I know when I was like younger, like, you know, cool people didn't wear their seatbelts, but nowadays, I mean, it's like just an automatic thing, not even a question. Everyone just put your seatbelt on, and it's not even a thought. But yeah, it's if he was wearing a seatbelt, he probably would not have died, because he had a passenger in the car, his cousin, who was wearing a seatbelt, and he just escaped with minor injuries. And, you know, it's a terrible thing he died. Seemed like a pretty good guy. But, you know, we know him as a baseball player, and this is a Mets podcast after all, so we kind of look at things in a baseball prism. And imagine how things might have played out if he didn't die. He probably would have made his debut in, like, 2002. Jose Reyes came up in 2003. David Wright came up in 2004. You know, imagine how things might have gone if Cole established himself as a major leaguer and was able to produce at half of those minor league numbers that he was able to put up. You know, 2006, 7, 8, that have all been pretty different, you know?
Yeah, have him out there in left field instead of
Brian Church, Xavier Nady.
I was going to say in 2006 instead of Andy Chavez, but actually that worked out. So
that did work, yes.
Who's in right field at that point? Sean Green?
I think. They traded for him at the end of 2006.
Yeah, I think so.
It was like a deadline acquisition, I think.
He was pretty good down the stretch, if I remember correctly.
Or was that to... No, he was in the playoffs. He was in the playoffs.
And I know he was... He
definitely was in the playoffs, in the 2006 playoffs.
And in 2007, they had Moises Alou, who was hurt majority of the year.
He could still hit when he was healthy, but yeah.
He could.
They had Cliff Floyd, too.
Cliff Floyd, yeah. I mean, it's not like... It's not
that
like
lineup
the Mets,
was stacked. Holy Christ.
It's not like the Mets did not have any outfielders. I mean, you had Carlos Beltran in center, you know, was a rock. So you always had that covered. And they had, you know, solid guys, be it Cliff Floyd, Moises Alou, Ryan Church, who was solid for a bit. Xavier Nady was solid for a bit. Fernando Tatis was solid for a bit. But you could have, you know, if Cole had established himself and was a pretty good player, you could have used those players as guys on the bench, or you could have used the resources that were used to either trade for them or sign them for other needs, you know, things like that. And
it changes the whole dynamic of the of the team. It bumps everyone down, which just makes the depth stronger.
I mean, the half inning after Andy made that catch, he came up with the bases loaded and did nothing. Maybe you have an actual hitter up there. That's different.
Mm-hmm. Plus, he was amazingly speedy. I mean, imagine him and Reyes, the amount of havoc they would have been able to cause on the base paths.
It would have been fun.
Mm-hmm.
That lineup was just stupid good, I'm remembering. Like, Jose Valentin was probably the worst hitter, and he had an above average year.
He was good that year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Who was supposed to play second?
I don't remember.
It Kaz Matsui.
Okay.
In 2006? Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah.
Because I remember Valentin being like a emergency option, and then he just hit and he played well, and they just kept him there.
Yeah, Kaz was still the starting starting second baseman. And I think like 2 weeks into the season or a month, whatever it was, they were just like, all right, we're just done here. It worked out though. So
yeah,
that's, I think that, you know, I'm not to get too much sidetracked here, but like so many things worked out that really should not have on those teams. And yet, you know, here we are, you know, a guy like Jose Valentin was just a scrap heap pickup, and he had an amazing season. Andy Chavez, same thing. You know,
Oliver Perez pitched the freaking game of his life in Game 7 and lost anyway.
Yeah, just so much. The stars just aligned constantly, and just nothing. It just slipped through their fingers. But yeah, so the moral of the story is always wear your seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
For real.
Extremely preventable. All right. Does anyone have any last words for the week? Aside for always wear your seatbelt.
Stay at home. Don't be an idiot.
Yes. Stay home.
Yep. Good advice.
Yep.
All right. So if anyone has any questions or comments, you can email us at our email address from complexqueens@gmail.com. You could follow us on Twitter. I am @SteveSipa. Lucas is @ElVlahos343. Ken is at KenLavin91, and Thomas is at SadMetSeasonSZN. Subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, and rate and review it. And obviously, thank you for listening. And same thing like last week, now that there is no baseball going on for the foreseeable future, if there's anything you'd like to hear topic-wise or whatever, you could send us emails, add us on Twitter, or write in the comments section on the podcast post what you'd like to hear about. So until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.
If there was a spreadable, cookable, bakeable plant-based butter that was better for your body and the planet, what would you make with it? Butter cookies? Butter pie? That's a thing, by the way. Whatever it is, Country Crock plant butter makes it happen and makes it delicious. Country Crock plant butter is so tasty, even butter lovers love it. You can use it as a one-to-one substitute for dairy butter in all of your favorite recipes and enjoy it, knowing it has 25% less saturated fat than regular old dairy butter. To try it for yourself, use the store locator at countrycrock.com/plant-butter today.